This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk to attorney Len Wineglass about the resentencing of Antonio Guerrero, one of the Cuban Five.
Despite an agreement between the U.S. attorney and Lenny Wineglass, Guerrero's attorney, the judge went above the agreement and gave Guerrero an additional 2 years tacked onto his 20-year sentence.
We'll discuss a renewal bill introduced by the House Judiciary Committee that might dismantle the current broad and overreaching surveillance laws.
Might is the right word. Apparently, despite sunset provisions in the Patriot Act, the sun never sets on surveillance.
Stay with us.
Michael, last week, the Court of Appeals in the Second Circuit here in New York, which is often called the second most important court in America next to the Supreme Court, came down with a horrific historical decision, R.R. versus Ashcroft, which legalizes torture. The United States can now outsource torture. The executive can do that to anyone, foreign or American, with impunity. Tell us how this came about.
I know our listeners have probably been following the Arar case for quite a while. He was the Canadian citizen who had been born in Syria, but on transiting through the Kennedy Airport in 2002, the U.S. snatched him off a transit flight, kept him in custody in the U.S. for 12 days under horrendous conditions, eventually took him, sent him to Syria, where it was very clear they sent him there to be tortured, and as they sent him there for that, and that's what happened to him. And after 10 months in prison, being tortured, he was finally released because of really huge international efforts in the figuring out of where the guy actually was. There's been a series of lawsuits around his case. The Canadians have actually screamed mea culpa, had a serious inquiry, and paid Arar some $9 million Canadian dollars for their role in this utter scandal. Arar, despite being completely innocent of anything, was not only tortured, but is still barred from the United States as an alleged terrorist. Well, the Center for Constitutional Rights has been representing Arar during this entire, what is now a 7-year period. And we've been meeting with little success in the court so far. And the biggest one just came down, the one you mentioned last week, which was a on-bank decision. That means all the judges of the Second Circuit in the United States courthouse down here at Foley Square sat on this case. It's a court right before the Supreme Court, the Second Circuit. And the decision was 7-4. I was at the argument. I saw the decision last week, and I was actually flabbergasted. I was shocked. I went to the argument. I thought it was going to be a close case because you have, you know, half a dozen Neanderthals sitting in the Second Circuit. But I still figured it would come out 7-5 in our favor, or it could have been, or there's only 11 judges now because Sonia Sotomayor went to the Supreme Court. How she would have come out, I don't know. But it was 7-4, which is an indication really about a number of things, how far to the right our courts have gone. And of course, in this case, this was a case that was originally brought under the Bush administration, argued under the Bush administration, but then the Obama administration retained the same position when asked, when pushed, as the Bush administration. So this is not a Bush case anymore. This is an Obama case, an Obama administration case protecting torturers. The case was against Ashcroft and others who'd sent Arar over to Syria. May not be legal or not to do what they did. But what good is it if it's illegal if you can't demonstrate in the court that it's illegal or get any damages for the unlawful conduct?
Yeah.
There's no remedy. What's the prohibition on anybody continuing to send people to torture?
And the judge who wrote the majority decision to define what we would mean by a right-wing court goes along with this whole notion of the unitary executive, that the executive is all-powerful and can't be challenged by the courts or by the legislature. And he said that this is a question of national security, of foreign policy, and we're not going to look into it. And we're going to bar the courthouse from access to people like Arar who have been victims of conspiracy, tortured. David Cole from the center who argued the case said you can conspire to send him over there to be tortured. Lawyers can't reach him while he's being tortured. And after he's tortured, he has no remedy in a U.S. court. And here you have the head of the majority opinion writer saying, we're going to bow to the executive and let him do this.
Michael, it's in some way, of course, it's not in the Supreme Court yet. And I'm not sure what they're going to do, but they're probably going to try and get it up there. It can't be worse. I mean, obviously can't be worse, and you don't want to leave this there, but it's like the Dred Scott of the torture cases. I mean, it's really essentially saying, here, U.S. officials took a completely innocent person who could have been sent back to Canada. They didn't send them back to Canada, and they sent him to Syria. They lie in the opinion, actually. One of the things the majority does is they say, well, Canada didn't want him back, and therefore, what choice did the U.S. have? Now, I was at the argument when they asked Cole, would Canada have taken him back? And there's two little facts here they omit. One is that he's a Canadian citizen, and therefore Canada has to take him back. And secondly, it came out in the record of the case that Canada was willing to take him back. So they just lie to try and get over that fact. So it's a nasty piece of business, this decision. And if we have any idea of the cruelty of this country and of some parts of our court system, that's a good indication of it.
One of the judges wrote, in its utter subservience to the executive branch, its distortion of the Bivens Doctrine, which we'll talk about in a second, its unrealistic pleading standards, its misunderstanding of the Torture Victim Protection Act, as well as its persistent choice of broad dicta where narrow analysis would have sufficed, the majority opinion goes seriously astray. And then Judge Guido Calabresi, who wrote an excellent dissent, says, it does so, moreover, with the result that a person whom we assume is A, totally innocent, B, was made to suffer excruciatingly, and C, through the misguided deeds of individuals acting under color of federal law, that's Ashcroft, the attorney general, is effectively left without a U.S. remedy. Calabresi went on in his dissent, very emotional, literary, and he says, because I believe that when the history of this distinguished court is written, today's majority decision will be viewed with dismay. I add a few words of my own, more in sorrow than in anger. He quotes Act 1, Scene 2 of Hamlet. Hamlet, he reminded us, is a tragedy.
I remember when Guido Calabresi, the judge you're quoting from, used to be the dean at Yale Law School, and at the argument, Guido apparently vacations or has a place in Italy. His family has Italian background. And he flies through France to go there, and he just couldn't really, when the court was going crazy in the argument, trying to figure out, is there something wrong with what they did here? He said, wait a second, you guys are telling me that I take a plane to Paris, and I'm on my way to Italy, and I'm changing planes at the Paris airport, that the French could pick me up, take me, and have me tortured in Syria, and that I would have no remedy, and they could do that to me? And Guido just could not get over the fact that he could be picked up off a plane in Paris and taken away. But it's no laughing matter. It's what could happen to anyone.
It's outsourcing torture, and it's an indication of the unchallenged growth and superiority of the executive branch over the other two branches of the government. The courts were set up to question the constitutionality of the laws that the legislature makes or the acts that the executive performs. That was supposed to be co-equal branches of government. And here you've got this right-wing judge saying that we're not going to do that anymore.
Terrible, terrible case. I don't know, the center hasn't decided, and Makar Arar hasn't decided whether to appeal to the Supreme Court yet, but we'll see what happens.
Well, let me read to you what Makar Arar said, Michael. After 7 years of pain and hard struggle, it was my hope that the court system would listen to my plea and act as an independent body from the executive branch. Unfortunately, this recent decision and decisions taken on other similar cases prove that the court system in the United States has become more or less a tool that the executive branch can easily manipulate through unfounded allegations and fear-mongering. If anything, this decision is a loss to all Americans and to the rule of law. Michael, there's some extraordinarily good news on the other hand coming out of Italy with the kidnapping of Abu Imar. Tell the audience what's happened.
We just got the extraordinary news, it's evening in Italy, that the Italian court has convicted 23 people in the kidnapping of an Egyptian cleric named Abu Omar. It's a kidnapping. It was a rendition on the streets of Milan 6 years ago or more, 7 years ago. He was kidnapped off the streets of Milan with the cooperation, or actually not the cooperation, it was the cooperation of the Italian CIA or whatever they call it over there, but it was done by the CIA. And there's been an incredibly aggressive prosecutor there named Armando Spataro. The case has taken 3, 4, 5 years. Armando sends us updates all the time. The one we just got is that 23 people were convicted of kidnapping Abu Omar, despite the objections of the Italian state to this trial.
Are these CIA agents?
Yes, these are CIA agents. 22 out of the 23, I think, are CIA agents. A couple of them were given diplomatic immunity, but essentially all of them were convicted. The question is what sentences they'll get, I don't know. But, of course, none of them are currently in Italy, although Armando Spataro, I think, knows the names of most of the agents, and there will be worldwide arrest warrants issued for them. And so the question is, what will happen to those guys if they try and move? I don't know. But these are valid convictions. After all, Abu Omar was actually kidnapped on the territory of Italy, and it was an illegal kidnapping.
Can the Italians ask that the CIA agents here in the United States be extradited back to Italy to serve time?
Yes, of course. Mr. Berlusconi, our wonderful prime minister in Italy, is free to do that. I think it's unlikely, but I think what can happen without that is I think the court can issue worldwide arrest warrants for the people, even without extradition proceedings going on. So these guys are in some trouble. Apparently the CIA people who had, one of them may have had a house in Italy, that's already a goner, and some other issues like that. So I think not only should these 22 CIA agents, but there were 23 defendants here, be terrified of any travel, you know, outside of their suburban shopping malls in Maryland, but so should all the other CIA agents in the world who've been involved in extraordinary rendition. And those people who, as we were speaking, rendered Arar to Syria could certainly be considered subject to this kind of a trial.
I think the CIA is going to have to lobby Congress to get a new version of the Witness Protection Act, protect our own employees from their illegal acts and give them a new identity and send them somewhere.
No, it's true. And, you know, Abu Omar, after he was taken from Italy, was tortured very badly in Egypt. You know, I've met Armando Spataro on a number of occasions, and he's extraordinary. I mean, he really believes in the rule of law. He showed how he got these guys, and he actually, you know, because they have prosecutorial powers, he traced down every cell phone, and from, like, let's say 10 blocks vicinity, they all the cell phone calls were aimed at a particular place where Abu Omar was kidnapped. He traced those cell phones to the CIA people and eventually nailed them. It's an extraordinary case, and I know Armando Spataro is going to be very pleased, but so are we. This is really the first really modicum of justice we've seen in one of these extraordinary rendition cases.
Michael, we got a victory in the Turkmen case right here in New York City. Tell us about it.
Well, that was a remarkable case. Again, right after 9/11, U.S. authorities, FBI and others, went rounding up Muslims all over the country. A lot of those Muslims wound up being dumped and literally dumped into prisons in New York and New Jersey, where they were heavily abused. They were put in those, what they call those three-piece suits, where they're shackled in their hands, belts, waists, and feet. They were beaten. They were terrorized. They were put under 24-hour surveillance. And then they were left in prisons months, just sitting there when they were completely innocent of any kind of terrorism charge. The Center for Constitutional Rights has brought a series of cases on behalf of some of those people. Most of those people have been sent back to their home countries. A lot of them were out of status. But in a recent development and a recent victory, the federal government settled with the Center for Constitutional Rights and five of our clients for over $1 million in total. And that's incredible because I remember when the center brought the case, everybody said, oh, this will never get anywhere. This is after 9/11. What is the right to be free from prison in these circumstances, et cetera? But in an extraordinary development, they actually—
What was the legal theory behind the complaint against the government?
Well, the legal theory, of course, you can't be beaten in prison at all. That essentially was the legal theory. Their argument was the higher-ups weren't responsible for this. They didn't know what was going on. But then, of course, the inspector general of the FBI put out a report that was just devastating that about what higher-ups knew and about how they misused their power in these prisons, that this was not a chance policy. So that was really it.
It seemed to me it was like anti-Muslim racism run rampant. They just let them abuse those people because of their religion.
There's no question about it. And they were all painted as terrorists when they went in there,
yeah.
Even though it was a guy who, let's say, forgot to notify immigration about a change in address. They picked that Muslim guy up, whether one's Egyptian or one's Iraqi or whatever, and they beat the heck out of him, called him terrorists, treated him as terrorists. And then finally, 5-6 years later, federal government was forced to settle. There's still more cases pending, but that's an important victory. For the center, of course, we lost the Arar case. We've now won the Turkmen case. And we also had another victory of sorts, which is one of our lawyers. I just saw a picture of her, Gita Gutierrez, who's one of our star Guantanamo lawyers. I saw a picture of her in the island nation of Palau. What's she doing in Palau? She traveled to Palau with six Uyghurs. Those are the people from Western China who were taken to Guantanamo, who had been there, you know, 7 years, completely innocent, but still were rotting in Guantanamo for 7 years. And I guess the best the U.S. could do is they try and close down at least the physical aspects of Guantanamo, as they got Palau, which is a
former New Hebrides. It's an island nation in the middle of nowhere in the South Pacific.
Right. So that's where the six Uyghurs are, but they seem pretty happy there. They've shaved their beards off in a way to blend in, you know, or at least not be as conspicuous. How long they'll be there, we don't know. It's probably a temporary place before they can get a more permanent home. But of course, many people thank Palau, which did obviously a major favor for the United States, because people remember Palau is one of the three countries that voted with the United States to keep the embargo of Cuba in the UN. Palau, Israel, and the United States.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, no, Palau is totally subservient. What's really extraordinary is that the United States, who put these poor people in that position to begin with, didn't accept them here. This country's not big enough for seven Uyghurs to come here somewhere. And there were people in this country that wanted to host them.
Yeah, I think that's
to help them. They wouldn't let them in.
Strong point, Michael. I think there were, I forgot how many total number of Uyghurs in Guantanamo, 17. Some are now in Albania. Some are in Bermuda. Some are in Palau. None of them are near their homes in Western China, which they don't want to be, but even in that part of the world where they could see their families. And there's a half a dozen more left in Guantanamo. Now, the point on the United States, which is really outrageous, is what Obama should have done, and this is where his caution really harmed him, is the day he took office and decided to close Guantanamo, he should have brought them in. By that time, it would have been a fait accompli. There wouldn't have been the revolt in Congress there's been now, which has actually passed a law barring any detainees from Guantanamo, except if they're brought here for trial, barring any detainees to come to the United States. So now he's in that pickle politically and probably legally as well. And we had a huge Uyghur community that actually would come to the courts in Washington as these people were declared innocent one after another and said, we are the Uyghurs of Washington. We will take these people into our homes. And despite that, they're sitting out in Palau. Unfortunate.
It's like an existential death. You know, right. A Uyghur from Western China now living in Palau. It says something about this country.
Right. I guess it's better than living in Guantanamo, Michael, but that's all you can say. But it's right at the feet of Bush and now Obama.
Earlier this month, federal judge Joan A. Leonard reduced the life sentence for Antonio Guerrero, one of the Cuban Five. Mr. Guerrero, a United States citizen, was convicted of spying for Cuba while working at the Naval Air Station in Key West, Florida. His sentence was reduced to almost 22 years, which means he could be out of prison in nearly 7 years. Mr. Guerrero's attorneys had asked for a sentence to be reduced to 240 months, which the U.S. government had agreed to, but Judge Leonard set it at 262 months. Mr. Guerrero's lawyer, Len Wineglass, told the New York Times it was an odd decision. He said, quote, "You have a man who was on a military base but who didn't take a single classified document, and no one testified that he injured U.S. national security, but the judge still rejects the prosecutor's request to lighten the sentence." Len Wineglass joins us to tell us more about the decision. Len Wineglass, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Len, you've been defending the Cuban Five for many years. These are men who were merely trying to protect the island against terrorism generated in Miami under the watchful eye of the United States government, which did nothing. I wanted you to give us an update on what's happened. They were sent to prison. You won, and your client, Guerrero, was supposed to be resentenced. You went down for the resentencing. Can you bring us up to date on what happened at the resentencing? What did you argue, and what kind of response did you get from the judge, and how did it go down?
Thanks, Michael. Antonio Guerrero, one of the five who I represent, was originally sentenced to life in prison. That sentence was also given to Ramon Labanino and to Gerardo Hernandez. The appellate courts reversed the life sentence for the charge of conspiracy to commit espionage against the three, but it only remanded for a new sentence as to two, my client Antonio and Ramon. It didn't remand for Gerardo because he was doing a life sentence already on another charge of conspiracy, that one conspiracy to commit murder. So we returned to Miami on Tuesday, October 13th, for the resentencing of my client, who was then serving life. Prior to the resentencing hearing on that date, we had negotiated with the government on the issue of sentencing alone, making it very clear there was no admission of guilt of the underlying charge, which we are still contesting in a later collateral attack. So on the sentencing issue alone, we agreed with the government that it should come down from life to a period of 20 years. That agreement was then laid before the court during the resentencing hearing in a six-page written agreement signed by both sides, including the head of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Miami. And the judge then took the very unusual step of setting the agreement aside and sentencing him against the agreement, not to a term of 20 years, but to a term of 21 years and 10 months, adding in effect 22 more months onto his sentence. Be that as it may, it means that Antonio, who up to that point in time was serving life, and under the federal rules he stays until he dies in a life sentence, will be returned home to Cuba within 7 years. Reciting, in effect, the indictment that this case involved a very serious matter, which was the government's contention 11 years ago, in which Cuban agents, of whom Antonio Guerrero was one, sought out top-secret information. That was her position 11 years ago, and it was that position which got reversed, because the appellate court said to her, you cannot give a person a life sentence on what they intended to get. You can only give a life sentence if they, in fact, got top-secret information, and in this case, there was no top-secret information that was gathered or transmitted back to Cuba. Therefore, the original sentence of life was wrong. But when we got back into the resentencing hearing, she began to restate her original position, as if the appellate court hadn't ruled that you can't do this. So it was a very tense moment, and it looked like the judge was going to revert back to a life sentence.
Well, I think that got your juices flowing, didn't it, Len? What did you tell the judge?
Well, I got very upset with that. The courtroom was packed with the same old crowd, the crowd in Miami that backs these paramilitary forces. They, of course, put the widows of the shoot-down up front in the front row, and then the rest of the crowd, they look like they are themselves either mercenaries or ex-men mercenaries. A lot of them are older. They sat there, and the judge was addressing that crowd. I got very upset with what I saw to be the climate that was being generated in that hearing. And so I reminded the judge very forcefully that she was sentencing an individual, not a country. And that's what the rules require. I had previously provided to the government and to the judge a series of documents in a booklet form, all of them government documents, all of them from the Bureau of Prisons, all of them saying that Antonio Guerrero, who was serving a faulty life sentence, which he never should have gotten, and was assigned to a maximum security prison where he never should have been sent because the sentence was wrong, nonetheless did 7 years in that prison, and the warden and the supervisor of the unit and his counselor all extolled his behavior and most significantly pointed out that he had helped save a number of inmates, all of whom were doing life sentences, from an incorrigible future by training them in English and math and overseeing their getting their GEDs. In other words, Antonio was doing what the prison system is supposed to do and doesn't do, that is help rehabilitate inmates. And that had to count for something. That hadn't happened the last time he was before the court for sentencing 8 years earlier. And the judge was dismissing it. It made me quite angry. And I tried to remind her that you're not sentencing Cuba, you're sentencing Antonio. And look at this record, and how can you discount it?
And I understand that after you told her that, she walked off the bench.
She called a recess. It was a fairly heated moment in the courtroom, and what judges frequently do when that happens, they flee the courtroom.
Len, the government did what it usually does with respect to Cuba. It broke its agreement again.
Yes.
And sending him away for a long, long time, far away in Colorado. The underlying unfairness of this and the fact that it has not been covered in the mainstream press and that they've stolen the lives of five people for only trying to defend their country against terrorism is so ironic that it's just an extraordinary kind of underground story that hasn't been covered, and who knows what's going to happen to it. My only speculation is that this judge, anyway, gave him not the time that you and the government had agreed to, but additional time because she's campaigning to get herself promoted to the Court of Appeals. You don't need to comment on that, but that's my reaction to this injustice.
Yes, I have no way of knowing that, Michael. But, you know, you're right. Antonio was 39 when he was arrested, and he'll be nearly 60 when he's released. And I told this to the judge during the argument. That's the heart of a lifetime. How many people would give up their ages from 39 to 60 in an enterprise that was meant to save lives in Cuba and to prevent a war between the two states? And he did that, and you're right, there's no acknowledgement of context here. There's no acknowledgement that this whole episode was provoked by a pattern of violence directed at Cuba, where over 3,000 people have died over the past 40 years from violence coming from southern Florida. And it was that violence which brought him here in order to infiltrate these groups and to warn Cuba. And since the five came to the United States to infiltrate those groups of mercenaries that exist quite publicly and openly in Florida, there has not been a single episode where property damage has occurred or an individual has been injured. So they performed their task. Nobody in the United States was harmed. No property was damaged. And they end up with life sentences for that operation. But there is, you're right, Michael, no context to this. The federal courts in these areas operate in an Orwellian world where the judge said to us, law has to be respected. And that was her argument. Well, my client respected the law. He entered into a negotiation with the government. He was willing to accept a substantial sentence. And what happened, as you pointed out, with this agreement? The first time it saw the light of day in a courtroom, it was dismissed by the court. Well, what does that say about respect for the law?
Lenny, can you give us an update on what's happening with the other four?
Yes, it's very unclear at this point. We're now 8 days past the sentencing of Antonio, and nothing has been resolved with respect to the other two who were scheduled to be resentenced. There are ongoing arguments and discussions between counsel, but there has been no resentencing date set for them. And I don't know where those cases are going to end up, although I hope and I expect that both of those sentences will come down as well. You know, something happened in Cuba yesterday. I don't think I can say it's directly related to the government agreeing with Antonio that his sentence should be cut short. But yesterday, the Cuban government released one of the dissidents and paroled another.
That's pretty interesting.
Yes. Now, the media is reporting it, and I read Reuters this morning, as a consequence of the visit to Cuba of the foreign minister of Spain. But the Cubans issued no statement relating it to that. But that's how the media views it. Of course, as you all point out, the media is totally unaware of what happened in Miami last Tuesday. So Cuba has taken that step, and I can't say that it's in reaction to what happened with Antonio or not, but it has in fact happened.
Len, I saw you at the press conference after the sentencing, and you said that you won't appeal the decision, but you will file an attack on the conviction itself. Can you explain that?
Yes, it's a good question, Heidi, because people think that Antonio came in and pled guilty. That didn't happen at all, and we made that clear right at the outset. He still will be appealing his conviction. What he agreed upon was a reduction in his sentence. And what we intend to do is we intend to file what used to be called a federal habeas and is now referred to as a Section 2255 collateral attack on his conviction. And we have until June of 2010, which is 1 year after the Supreme Court denied the review of his case. The statute gives you up to 1 year to file a collateral attack on your conviction, and we will do that. And that attack is limited. It can only be filed on issues of a constitutional nature that were not previously litigated. For instance, the venue issue that we won initially, only to have it reversed, cannot be again attacked because that has already been litigated. But there are other issues. To give you an example, it came to light after our case was appealed that the federal government was paying members of the press in Miami as part of their anti-Castro government campaign to write articles. And articles were written about this case that were highly prejudicial by people who were reporters but were on the federal payroll. Now the question is, can the government be responsible for creating a prejudicial atmosphere by paying reporters to write anti-Castro materials and at the same time defend against a change of venue?
Wait, I don't understand. You're saying the government paid reporters?
Yes. They were being paid out of the funds for Radio Marti to write materials that were broadcast on Radio Marti that were propaganda against the Cuban government. But at the same time, they were reporters for other legitimate media, so-called legitimate media, like the Miami Herald. And these were the reporters who were writing highly prejudicial materials on the case.
It's amazing, Lenny. That's just, I mean.
It's just amazing.
What can you say?
I mean, I remember in the old Cold War days, so the big attack against, say, the Soviet Union was that their journalists were not objected, that they were on the payroll of the government, you know, and this violated all kinds of notions of human liberty. They've now managed to overthrow the government of the Soviet Union. They're borrowing the same tactics. It's just extraordinary that happened.
We're finding out through the Freedom of Information Act. We have it clear on several of them, but we're probing it even deeper, and we hope to get that information more complete by June of 2010, so we'll have a basis for argument. There are other issues as well that we're going to be filing on, particularly issues that go to the conviction of Gerardo Hernandez, who is serving a double life sentence and who should not be in that position at all. But we will be unearthing information about what brought about his conviction as well.
Len, if people want to support the Cuban Five, do you have a website that we can recommend them to go to?
Yes, there's a Free the Five website on the Internet. That's one. And I think there are links to others as well. But that's the principal one. That one, by the way, has put up in the last, I'd say, 2 or 3 days, a very beautiful poem written by Antonio, who is a poet, my client. He's also an artist.
We're going to read the third stanza, Lenny, and then maybe you can give us a reaction to it.
Okay.
Once again, orange jumper. Once again, solitude between bricks. Once again, broken mattress without pillow. Once again, big noise in the hall. Once again, to change clothes once a week. Once again, a tiny yellow pencil. Once again, by a miracle, a phone call. Once again, to walk without destiny. Once again, a cage to recreate. This time, even they don't give coffee. Once again, dirty floor, cold shower. Once again, a cop-out to complain. And of course, they don't answer once again. Once again, whole. And once again, poetry.
Yes, that's beautiful. That is Antonio. That's exactly as I know him. And as anyone who's come across him knows him. I mean, he was at the most hard-nosed prison in the United States. And after 7 years, the warden of the prison wrote the Regional Bureau of Prisons asking that Antonio be released from that institution because he doesn't deserve to be there. For me, that's practically unprecedented. But that's Antonio, and that's the way he is. He is a poet in his soul, and he helping people is a major part of his character. He's just a lovely, sensitive man.
Len, just as a reminder, if listeners do not recall, this government has been especially punitive in not allowing the families to visit.
That's true. With respect to two of the five, Rene Gonzalez and Gerardo Hernandez, their wives have not been given visas so they could travel from Cuba to the United States to see their husbands. That's been true for more than 10 years.
Well, it's a somber note on which to end, Len. Thank you for giving us an update on this case, and we look forward to hearing about preparations for the next filing in 2010.
Yes, thanks, Heidi, and thank you all for having me.
Thank you, Len.
Bye, Len.
Yeah, so long, Len.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Here we go again. The Patriot Act provisions allowing broad government spying are sunsetting, or supposedly sunsetting. What that means is they're supposed to expire. But of course, there we are. Our Congress, like sheep or sheep to each other, are going to follow the old Patriot Act and renew those provisions, or that is what it appears that they're going to do. More wiretapping, more information on Americans. That's what the Patriot Act is in part about. And sadly, the Obama administration appears to be going along with renewing very nasty provisions for government spying. Today we're joined by Kevin Bankston, senior staff attorney specializing in free speech and privacy law at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Kevin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
The House of Representatives introduced their own USA Patriot Act reform bill. Can you explain to us what is expiring?
Sure. As you all recall, the USA Patriot Act passed in a rush after 9/11 back in 2001. A bunch of provisions were set to expire in 2005. Most of those were renewed, a few with some minor improvements. But that left three provisions that were set to expire at the end of this year. And actually, only two of those are Patriot provisions. One of them came in a later intelligence bill. And those are the provisions that expanded the government's power to get orders from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court for any tangible thing, mostly business records. These are often called Section 215 orders after the Patriot section. Roving wiretaps, or more accurately, roving John Doe wiretaps, where the government can get a wiretap order, but one that doesn't specify the name of the target or the facility to be wiretapped, be it a phone number or an email address or a particular telecommunications facility. And then finally, the provision that was not passed as part of Patriot but was passed later, something called the Lone Wolf Authority. And this is the authority whereby the government can obtain wiretapping orders from the FISA court for people who are unrelated to any foreign power but are suspected of engaging in or preparing for crimes related to terrorism. This is worrisome because the entire foreign intelligence surveillance system is premised on the idea that the president has special authority when it comes to dealing with foreign threats. But when you unmoor that authority from foreign organizations, be they governments or terrorist organizations, it starts to look unconstitutional under the Fourth Amendment. And so those are the three provisions that are expiring. And although they're worrisome, they're probably not the most worrisome parts of the Patriot Act and certainly not the most worrisome parts of our surveillance laws. The most worrisome part of the Patriot Act, which most is in dire need of reform, is the National Security Letter Authority. This is the authority whereby the FBI, without any court supervision, can simply write a letter demanding private records of Americans, including bank and credit records and telephone and internet records, without any link to terrorism, but simply by certifying that they think those records are going to be relevant to their investigation.
And does the individual know if he or she is being the subject of that?
Absolutely not. National security letters, along with all Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act process or FISA process, is super secret. And the people who receive the requests, be they NSLs or demands to assist in wiretapping, are gagged from ever disclosing those. And one of the big problems in this area has been the difficulty of those people receiving that legal process from challenging those gags when they want to. And some of the reforms are targeted at making it easier for them to do so. But short of that, the target is never notified that these processes were used against them, unless, of course, they're prosecuted and this stuff is used as evidence in their criminal trial. But one of the main premises of foreign intelligence surveillance is that it's not about criminal law enforcement. It's about spying on the spies and spying on the terrorists. So in many ways, this world is a black box, and we don't know how these powers are being used, except when we do get windows into that world, it's very disturbing. For example, the Inspector General of the FBI has now written two investigative reports finding that the national security letter power has been significantly abused and overused and misused.
Kevin, just to go back one second, the national security letters are separate from Section 215 orders.
They are separate from Section 215. Unlike the Section 215 orders, which are obtained from the secret FISA court, NSLs are issued directly by FBI agents.
Got it.
Without any court's supervision or oversight.
Kevin, can you just go into a little bit more detail about the roving wiretaps? It's hard for me to understand how, if you don't have the name of anybody,
Or the place.
What does the warrant say?
Well, that's a good question. We've never seen these warrants. They sound, worrisomely, a whole lot like the general warrants that our founders rebelled against. You know, these were the warrants of the king that basically allowed the king's men to search for evidence of a crime wherever it might be found. And that's why our Fourth Amendment requires that every warrant state with particularity the person or place to be seized or searched. You'll often hear defenders of the roving wiretap provision say, but we have this authority in the law enforcement context. Why shouldn't we be able to use it against terrorists? And that's not what civil libertarians like us are arguing. The problem is this authority is much broader than what they have in the law enforcement context. In the law enforcement context, if you want a roving wiretap, that is a wiretap order, that is an order that doesn't specify the facility that's going to be wiretapped, then you have to name the target. Otherwise, you can just get by with a description of the target if that's all you have. But you need one or the other. And the few courts that have signed off on roving wiretaps in the criminal context said this was why they were constitutional, because the particularity about the person was enough to overcome the lack of particularity about the place. But here in the Patriot context, these John Doe roving wiretaps lack particularity of either person or place, and we think they pretty clearly violate the Fourth Amendment. And so most of the reform proposals regarding roving wiretaps aren't to let that provision expire completely, but it is to make it more like the criminal law and require them to actually identify the target if they're going to get a roving wiretap.
Kevin, what is the response or position of the Obama administration to these proposed reforms?
The Obama administration has been very disappointing on these issues, considering Senator and candidate Obama's previous campaigning, saying that he would work to reform the Patriot Act, his previous support of bills that contain some of the reforms that his administration is now rejecting. Basically, the administration came out at the beginning of this process, which started way too late this year, considering the deadline, was that we think these three provisions should be reauthorized, but we're open to discussing reforms that would better protect Americans' privacy, which was a somewhat hopeful sign because, again, you know, like with roving wiretaps, no one is saying that Section 215 should be allowed to expire. Rather, they simply want to introduce meaningful reforms. On the other hand, with the Lone Wolf Authority, most of the reformers think it should simply be left to expire because it's clearly unconstitutional. So some promising words from the Obama administration, but they were undermined a couple of weeks ago in the Senate. To give you a little background about what's been happening in the Senate, last month, Senator Feingold, always a staunch proponent of civil liberties, he was the one senator to vote against the Patriot Act back in 2001. He and Senator Durbin introduced an incredible reform bill called the Justice Act, which would have comprehensively but reasonably reformed a great many Patriot Act authorities, not just the ones that are expiring, as well as, and this is critical, reforming the surveillance powers granted under the FISA Amendments Act that was passed last summer, which in many ways Patriot Act pales in comparison to the powers that were granted by this law, which allows the government to warrantlessly wiretap international communications of Americans, and also granted immunity to phone companies that assisted in the NSA's illegal warrantless wiretapping program. That was somewhat prompted by our own lawsuit against AT&T for assisting in that. And so we think that although Patriot Act reform is important, addressing it without addressing the FISA Amendments Act is kind of like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. And so we were very happy to see that this justice bill contained FAA reform, FISA amendments reform, including a repeal of the telecom immunity, which would revive our cases, which have been dismissed. But unfortunately, Senator Leahy, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, a couple of weeks later, instead of sponsoring Feingold's bill, came out with his own bill. It didn't address the FISA Amendments Act at all. And although it had some meaningful Patriot reforms, it wasn't nearly as ambitious as Senator Feingold's. And that was the bill that the Judiciary Committee considered 2 weeks ago. In that meeting, or what's called a markup, when they consider amendments to the bill and then whether to recommend it to the floor, the Republicans offered a bunch of amendments to remove reforms from the already watered-down bill, which, by the way, had been watered down once again in negotiations with Senator Feinstein, who heads the Intelligence Committee. And so we're already looking at a very watered-down reform bill compared to Feingold's gold standard in the Justice Act. Then, on the day of the markup, the Republicans offer a bunch of amendments that they say they got from the Obama administration to remove the few reforms that were left. Not only is the Obama administration falling down on its promise to help reform the Patriot Act, it's actually working through Republicans, strangely, to make these bills even worse. And so that's the bill that was reported out of the Judiciary Committee a couple of weeks ago and is soon going to go to the floor. And considering how disappointing that bill was, it was incredibly important that the House come out with a great bill, and that happened. Representative Conyers, who's chair of the Judiciary Committee in the House, along with Jerry Nadler of the Constitution Subcommittee and Bobby Scott of the Crime and Terrorism Subcommittee, came out with two bills, one focused on Patriot, with most of the reforms that were in the excellent Justice Act from Senator Feingold, and a separate bill to reform the FISA Amendments Act, which includes the repeal of telecom immunity and, importantly, a provision that would prevent the bulk collection of Americans' emails and phone calls under that law.
Mentioning the telecom lawsuits, what is the status of Electronic Frontier suits, and what do you think will happen if this new reform bill passes?
Well, we have two lawsuits. Our first was brought against AT&T in early 2006 when, based on news reports and whistleblower evidence that we got from an AT&T technician, it became clear that the warrantless wiretapping program wasn't the narrow and targeted program that the president claimed, but actually involved the NSA having backdoor access to key domestic telecommunication switches, whereby the NSA was sucking up millions upon millions of communications and then sorting out the stuff they were interested in. The way I like to describe it is, we used to do surveillance in a retail manner. You figured out who you wanted to wiretap and you targeted and wiretapped that person. But we've moved to a wholesale system where they wiretap everybody and then pick out who they want to target after they've collected everything. So we sued AT&T over that because that violated a broad swath of federal surveillance laws. And we think that the phone companies are true gatekeepers. If they're not willing to say no when the government secretly comes to them and asks them to break the law, then all of our privacy is in big trouble. And so we sued AT&T over that. Congress passed this telecom immunity last summer. And our case, along with a couple dozen other cases against other telecoms, were dismissed earlier this year. That's not a final decision. That was a decision by the district court. We are appealing that to the Ninth Circuit. And from there, it could go to the Supreme Court. But if this repeal of the immunity passes and the cases aren't fully dead, we haven't had all of the appeals exhausted, our cases can be revived, and it'll be as if the immunity statute had never passed. That's very important to us, and we think there is a chance of that. We also think there's a chance of substantial Patriot reform and hopefully FISA amendments reform.
Didn't Obama vote for the immunity?
Obama,
he was a senator?
As they like to say on the Hill, he voted for it after he voted against it. He supported it after he opposed it. He strongly opposed immunity as a senator and a candidate, and voted for an amendment to the bill that would have stripped the immunity out. So he actually voted against the immunity, but he did ultimately, when that amendment failed, still voted for the overall bill, even though it contained immunity, because he, I gather, along with many other Democrats, had been convinced that the surveillance law changes in that bill were critical and necessary, which we don't agree with. But regardless, Obama had made a lot of noises about how immunity was a very bad thing. And so when he came into office, we were hoping that might change the game, because he, without resort to Congress, could end the immunity fight today by having his attorney general withdraw the certification on which the immunity is based. Basically, the way the immunity works, it's kind of scary. The attorney general becomes the judge and jury, essentially. The law says if the attorney general files a certification to the court saying what they allege didn't happen, or I think it was legal and that they received the appropriate legal process, or even if they didn't receive the appropriate legal process and it wasn't legal, the president said it was okay. And if the attorney general certifies one of these things to the court, it's a secret certification, we don't know which one or which ones he did, then the court has to dismiss, and that's what happened.
Yeah, so Obama first voted for the immunity as a senator as part of the larger bill, and then when he became president, he did the certification that would mandate that the court dismiss the cases. Is that it?
Well, no, the former attorney general under the Bush administration did file the certification before Obama came into office, but now there is a new attorney general, and that attorney general could have withdrawn that certification, but that did not happen. We are looking to Congress now because it's clear that the White House doesn't intend to fix this problem.
I want to remind our audience that we're speaking with attorney Kevin Bankston, who's the senior staff attorney specializing in free speech and privacy law with the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Equal Justice Works.
So there is another case that we're working on, though, in this area. There's a second lawsuit. During the immunity debate, one of the arguments for the immunity was, hey, you should just be suing the government. And aren't they really the ones responsible anyway? Why are you holding these telecoms responsible? And so we did that. We brought a lawsuit against the NSA and several other agencies and officers, including in their personal capacity, including Vice President Cheney and his lawyer, David Addington, basically on the same arguments and theories that we had used in our AT&T case. And lo and behold, the Obama administration's positions in that litigation have been as bad, if not worse, than the Bush administration's, in that not only has the Obama administration argued that the entire case has to be dismissed immediately because to try and litigate it would risk the disclosure of state secrets, they're essentially claiming that the entire subject matter of the NSA program, which has been front page news for years, is still somehow a secret. But they've gone even farther and said, we also believe that the United States has sovereign immunity, essentially an immunity against relief, sovereign immunity against for violations of any of the federal surveillance statutes. So they're basically saying all of those federal surveillance statutes that the Congress wrote specifically to restrict and control government spying actually don't apply to us, the federal government, which we think is wrong, and we're waiting for a decision that hopefully will prove they are wrong. But in the meantime, it really puts the lie to that argument made during the immunity debate. You know, first they say, well, you should sue the government, and now the government's saying, oh, actually, you can't sue anyone.
Kevin, I wanted to ask you for your advice to our listeners about what they can do to support Jerry Nadler's bill and the other things that can try to do some good against this impenetrable tide rising against us and closing off our civil liberties. What can our listeners do? Are there websites, phone calls? Tell us.
Certainly. On the Senate side, certainly contacting your senator and saying that you'd like to see amendments made to the Patriot Bill to add some of the reforms that were in the Justice Bill would be very helpful. And if those amendments aren't added, I'd urge my senator to vote no on that bill. In the meantime, in the House, what's really important, I think, for the Conyers bill is that it get as many sponsors as possible before the Judiciary Committee considers it in a couple of weeks, ideally sponsors who are actually on the House Judiciary Committee. So letting your representative know that you support Mr. Conyers and Mr. Nadler and Mr. Scott and their excellent bills, not just the Patriot bill, but their FISA reform bill, I think could be critical. There's been an unfortunate lack of coverage of this issue in the mainstream press, unfortunately, and I think that a lot of people on the Hill are starting to think that the American people don't care about this issue. And so every voice counts. Right now, if you go to EFF.org, our website, we currently have an Action Center item where you can contact senators about their bill. And we'll soon have an alert targeted at the House as well. So if you want something to help you through the process of contacting your representative or senator, that's where you can go. Go to EFF.org and click on Action.
And Kevin, we at Law and Disorder will put a link on our website. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you, and hopefully we'll have you back on with some positive news.
I hope so, and I look forward to it.
Excellent work of EFF.
Much appreciated. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.